Welcome to Life Transformation Radio. This show is all about life transformations and our journey from where we were to why we are doing what we are doing today. We will discuss the hiccups, the roller coasters, and the blood, sweat, and tears that has been poured out while discovering our purpose. It is all about our transformations. Here is your host, Sean Douglas.
Welcome to Life Transformation Radio. I am your host, Master Resilience Implementer, TEDx speaker, performance enhancement expert, and author, Sean Douglas. I want to welcome all of our listeners who are listening from wherever you are. This show is currently heard in over 30 countries, such as the US, India, Canada, Panama, France, Australia, Norway. Oh, thank you so much to those who are listening from around the world. Life Transformation Radio is all about our transformations. Here, we tell the stories of why we're doing what we're doing. We highlight that transformational moment that has changed our lives and how we're using these to help transform others and elevate their lives as well. You can listen to us every Wednesday and on the first and third Fridays at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And on the show are impactful and amazing guests that are impacting everyone around them and creating great big things. So my guests today, this is actually a special episode. I host these special episodes for product launches, book launches, but today is a special episode that we're going to talk about suicide, suicide awareness, the connection between suicides and PTSD, and we're going to attack this thing because we all feel like this is an epidemic that is kind of getting out of hand. You know, I heard something the other day that a 14-year-old was cyberbullied to the point of suicide. I'm like, 14? Like, I have a 14-year-old son, and it inspired me to do this show. And so I want to welcome all of my experts on the show. We have Dr. John Scherer. We've got Richard Lambert, Dr. Aaron Oxel, and we have Megan Fenyo. So if I mess up your name, I'm really sorry. I'll just say that off the bat. But I want to welcome everybody to the show. So we'll start with Dr. John. Man, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Sean. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Hey, Richard. How you doing, man?
Hey, doing great, Sean. Thank you for bringing me on. Pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Dr. Aaron Oxel, how are you doing?
Hello, everybody. What an honor to be here. Thank you.
And Megan Fenyo, is that right? How do you say your last name?
You said it right the first time, Fenyo, so the E is silent.
What? So Fenyo, okay, so Megan Fenyo.
Yep.
So yeah, please, all right. So welcome to the show. This is going to be amazing. And very quickly, I'm going to read off a little bit about everybody. The Facebook has been blowing up and everybody's, you know, telling their stories and everything, but I just want to get everybody who hasn't seen it just a kind of a little context of what we're dealing with. So Dr. John Scherer has taught 10,000 plus people to manage their anger, become calmer, happier, and more successful. He's a UC Berkeley graduate with a psychology PhD in psychology. He provides clients with scientifically supported coaching to make the most of their personal and professional potential. Pixar's Inside Out expert. I thought that was pretty awesome. His blog, Shrunken Mind, has all kinds of awards. He's an award-winning book, How Can I Be Happy? And you can go to webangermanagement.com or go to guidetoself.com, and you can check out all of his stuff. Richard Lambert is a 22-year active-duty Air Force retiree and retired Department of the Air Force federal employee of 17 years. He was a 4th Fighter Wing at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in Goldsboro, North Carolina. He was the community support coordinator, which basically he reports directly to the wing commander, the base commander. He served as the chair for the integrated delivery system and executive director of the wing's community action information board. He was solely responsible for the wing suicide prevention program and the wing resilience program, which covers over 6,000 personnel, military personnel, and families on that base. He has a bachelor's in human resource management with a postgraduate studies in business. He also worked in the mental health facility with the Airman and Family Readiness Center, you know, with the military, and he's got a big, robust background in this area. Megan Fenyo is a licensed clinical social worker in both California and Michigan. And has worked in the field for the past 15 years, and I thought this was awesome. In 2012, commissioned as an officer in the Air Force. As a captain, she provided mental health and substance abuse treatment to fellow military members and veterans. Since she has separated from the military, she's a full-time hospital mental health therapist, owner of Health Food Franchise, and business owner of Mission Strength. You go to missionstrengthsd.com. Again, www.missionstrengthsd.com. And Dr. Erin Oaksel earned her clinical psychology doctorate from the University of Nevada in Reno. She's a 15-year cognitive behavioral psychology expert. That is literally what Mr. Lambert and I talked about in Resilience. Our Resilience program is based off of like the cognitive behavioral theories, like all that stuff. She has published in 10 peer-reviewed psychology journals and books. You can go to www.psychologyofmission.com. Again, www.thepsychologyofmission.com. So we are here to address suicides, suicidal ideations. I'm a suicide survivor. I think Erin said that she was a suicide survivor. There's just so much going on in the world right now. And let me start off, you know, right now, I'm just going to write down the road. So Dr. John, what do you think is one of the most contributing factors to suicide?
Well, I think one of the biggest factors is actually prior attempts. If you look at research, the number of attempts done prior to a completed attempt at suicide is the biggest indicator. The second one is actually a history of deliberate self-harm. And there's a theory out there by Dr. Thomas Joyner at Florida State University, and his theory says that people need to kind of work up to completion of suicide. So you do this by getting systematically desensitized to things like violence, seeing blood. And so anything like self-harm, anything like childhood physical and sexual abuse, those are all pretty big indicators that this person is serious and potentially has the courage to follow through on a suicide attempt or a suicide threat.
Wow. Richard, what do you think, man?
Okay, you know, I agree with Dr. John there. But, you know, we're living in a modern-day society that is, in my opinion, too fast-paced. There's too much noise in the world. Our everyday environment can be sometimes very cold and uncaring, and the demands of life can be all-consuming. So it's just a crazy, hectic period in our society where we're in warp speed, and sometimes that reality definitely builds to the point where people want an out, and unfortunately, they don't, in some cases, choose healthy directions to meet that challenge. Unfortunately, sometimes that leads to depression and ultimately for some suicide attempts, if not suicide. So it's a crazy world we're living in. You know, the key question is how do we help one another along the journey of life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Megan, what do you think?
Excuse me. I agree with everything that's been said so far. Definitely the history of self injury behavior is an indication. Also, I definitely think too, support systems and what does this person really think about mental health treatment? So if there's a stigma about getting mental health treatment, that definitely is, you know, an indication that they feel isolated and that they may be seen as weak if they're, you know, going to go and get mental health treatment. So I definitely think, you know, those are factors and definitely the support system that you have around you.
Yeah, definitely. Dr. Erin.
Well, adding on to what everyone said, I think there's some great research that suggests that we've become a culture that is pretty poor at doing a pretty poor job of tolerating suffering. And so we've become a culture of, you know, quick, fast tricks and hacks and happy, and take this and take that. And what we know from research is the more that we actually talk about, yeah, life has some suffering in it, the less powerful it can be. And so I think we're seeing the pendulum swing to the other side. You know, we went through the whole, you know, everyone's a winner just by participating. And we got kind of kicked in the butt over that. And we're, the pendulum
right.
the other side, too. So I think because of that, we're going to go back to hopefully building up some resiliency and expectation that, no, to be human is the good, the bad, and the ugly. And if we talk about that, it becomes less pathological.
Absolutely. So some of the facts that I pulled right off of the suicide website is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. And I saw, I think it was Dr. Aaron's post, that somebody had said it's the second leading cause in postpartum moms. I believe that's what it was. Yep. Each year, 44,960. Yep. Oh, yeah, that's what it was, postpartum depression. Each year, 44,965 Americans die by suicide. For every suicide, 25 people attempt it. Suicide costs the U.S. $51 billion annually. The annual age-adjusted suicide rate is 13.5 per 100,000 individuals. Men die by suicide 3.5 times more than women. On average, there are 123 suicides a day. That I was blown away, 123 suicides a day. White males accounted for 7 of 10 suicides in 2016. Firearms contribute to 51% of all suicides. The rate of suicide is highest in middle age, white men. Some of those stats are just wow. Some of those stats are staggering, 123 a day. I've never told my story at all, and I won't tell all of it, but just that, here's the key point. I'm a suicide survivor. My mom and dad divorced when I was in first grade. My mom remarried a guy who was an alcoholic, a drug abuser, and a womanizer and a physically abuser, whatever. They married when I was in second grade. From the time I was in third grade till the time I was in seventh grade, I was physically abused. My older sister was physically abused. My mom was beat up constantly, almost weekly. And it got to a point by sixth grade, it was almost an everyday thing. He'd go on binges, and I came home one time and he's doing drugs on the coffee room on the living room coffee table. It was just that's what I grew up in. I grew up in an alcohol dominated domestic violence household, and I learned to mask my pain. I learned to, oh yeah, everything's good. Don't tell nobody what's going on, because my mom told us, don't tell nobody what's going on. Don't tell anybody. From the time that I was born to the time I was 18, I lived in 11 different houses, and I moved to 8 different schools. Because we either got kicked out, evicted, we lived with my grandparents, so I didn't have a loving, stable household. This is a question for everybody. Do you think that just that alone has a factor that will send someone down a suicide road if they don't deal with those, like, and address those childhood trauma?
Hey, Sean, this is Megan Fenio.
Yeah.
And so in my practice, I focus on PTSD and substance abuse. And, you know, I do have to say, growing up in a very abusive home as well myself, and all of the ups and downs of that, and, you know, the trauma that is instilled in our brains and in our lives, I definitely 100% agree that if, you know, people are not getting treatment for these issues, then yes, that is a major indication and a factor in those people, you know, feeling like they have no way out, because their emotions and, you know, the feelings are just so, so intense that, and it's painful, you know, it's physically painful, and they just want to escape that pain, which is why they turn to drugs or alcohol or, you know, this ending their life. And so I definitely 100% agree.
Hey, this is Dr. John here. Let me just jump in, because I think that in the story you told, you've got one of the leading indicators there, which is physical abuse during childhood. However, not everyone that's physically abused commits suicide. I mean, just the same way that not everyone that's hopeless commits suicide. So we have some of these indicators, but I think that the more that we can address these topics, talk about them, the better off we're going to be. The other part of it that's big is two of the main predictors, I guess, is the feeling that you're a burden to your family and that you're disconnected from pretty much everyone else around you. So if those two conditions are met, then you've got a much higher risk of suicidal ideation. So hopefully in your case,
yeah,
I don't think that's true.
I felt alone. Like literally, like when I was 18, like I didn't fit into the, I wasn't, I played high school football. I played hockey. Like I was on a teams all the time, but I wasn't, I didn't feel loved. You know, I wasn't tucked in at night, you know, but I didn't hang out with the jocks or the freaks or the preps or the, you know, whatever you call the social classes like they have in high school. I didn't have one set of social group. I just went to class. I just hung out with whoever wanted to hang out with me, but I felt like I wasn't approved of or liked by everybody. And that just set me down a hopeless path. So here I go into the military and I discover alcohol at an early age. So I joined the military. I graduated high school with a 1.9. I wasn't getting into college. We didn't have enough money. 9/11 happened. I go into the military. When I got to England, when I was 19, I found alcohol and I quickly dove in all the way and I was drunk all the time. And I found it as a way to escape because I didn't have to feel anything when I was drinking and you know, everybody's drinking. So nobody knows what burdens you're carrying around. Nobody knows what struggles you just are going through in your mind. And by 2004, I was an alcoholic, you know. In 2005, I did my first time in ADAPT, which in the Air Force is the what you specialized in. I was in the alcohol, drug, and
yep,
and
the ADAPT
prevention
program.
Treatment, and yep, and mm-hmm. yep, and that's what I did. I was in the alcohol, drug, and alcohol prevention and treatment program, you know, for abuse. And at the time in 2005, it was like a week or 2 weeks or something like that. But you couldn't drink, you couldn't, you know, do any of that stuff. And of course, we try to hide it and try to get away with it. But now, I mean, in the military, they'll kick you out like fast. Like they'll alleviate you quick. But I did that my first time. I went to anger management. I was in counseling, and then I was good for maybe 6 months or so until I went through a breakup. And went through a very bad breakup, and it set me down the same path. Because oh, that's it. I'm not loved. Nobody wants me. Nobody, you know, cares about me. Whatever. And by 2007, I was a functioning alcoholic, and I tried to hide it from everybody until my wife left me. And when my wife left me and the military found out that I was drinking all the time, because I showed up to work drunk and got charged with an Article 112, which is a drunk on duty charge. I was charged with an Article 112 and they were kicking me out. They're like, you're done. Like, see you later. Like, I lost my house because my house burned down during one of my parties. My wife left me and the kids, you know, she took them, and I'm sitting there Christmas Eve 2008 with a gun in my hand. I'm like, I'm just going to end it because I'm never going to stop drinking. I'm always going to be a burden to people is what I felt. Nobody loves me. I mean, why? What is my purpose? I have no purpose in life other than to wake up, go into the military, and that's it. I mean, that's what I felt like. But, I mean, I'm doing amazing things in the military. I'm building a business on the side. I'm doing great things on paper. But in my heart and in my mind, I was just a burden to everybody, and I just wanted to end it. So I put a gun in my mouth, and I wanted to end it. But I didn't end up going through with it. People stopped me. I got phone calls, and people were like, oh, my God, I'm really – and people reached out to me. But that's not always the case. They don't always reach out to you. What are some ways that we can identify if someone is suicidal? I'll leave it to the floor because I'm sure this is going to be – I mean, everybody's got their ideas. But, I mean, how can we – what are some signs and symptoms that someone is going to be suicidal?
Oh, that's tricky. It's interesting. This is Dr. Aaron, and even in psychology, the research shows we're not that much better at predicting it than the layperson, but we've covered some of those risk factors, and it's definitely if they've hurt themselves in the past or you know, attempted in the past. But it's also this general sense of hopelessness, and sometimes people are so scared to admit they're having thoughts of taking their life. And by kind of opening up the conversation and normalizing, like, hey, we can talk about that here. That doesn't mean that there's anything weird about you or that I have to admit you, you know, in a clinical situation. But really saying, like, every week maybe we could check in about, like, how you're feeling in terms of suicide sounding like a good option. When you open that up, it can be such a relief for people that they have a space to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, when I was suicidal probably 10 years ago, I felt the same way. And I thought my children are better off without me. And I knew 100% believed I would never, ever be happy again. Like, it wasn't a question. I wasn't being melodramatic. It wasn't being pessimistic. It was like 100% reality in my brain. I'm literally one of the happiest mm-hmm. people I know right now in my
yeah.
life. But if you could have told me that back then, I wouldn't have believed you. And so when people are hearing people say things like that, it's time to say, you know what? This is a disease in your brain. This isn't you. Like, let's go fight this disease and have a team mm-hmm. that supports and kind of rallies around. Let's fight this disease. It's not Aaron. Aaron's not depression. Aaron's Aaron having a bout of depression.
Good.
Well, and Sean, if I can jump in.
Anyone else?
This is Dr. John.
Yeah.
I think that I'm really pleased that you're doing this show today, because I think one of the most important things is to be able to talk about it freely and openly and get the word out. I mean, I can't tell you how many men that I've talked to that come in and they say, well, you know, I've had these thoughts of killing myself. And I'm like, oh yeah, me too. Like, it's normal. To me, it's more normal than not to have thoughts of suicide. I don't get freaked out about the thought of suicide, because that's kind of what our mind does. Our mind is just a random thought generating machine. And sometimes it spits out helpful thoughts. Sometimes it's unhelpful. But I think until you can have that honest conversation about, this is what I'm thinking, this is how I'm feeling, there's not much you can do. If, you know, the people that worry me the most are the people that have these thoughts and these feelings and don't tell a soul about it. If someone's talking to me about
hard.
It, I can help them out. If they're not talking to me about it, that's a tough one. So I try and normalize my client's experience by saying, yeah, I've had those thoughts before in the past too. I think most people have. I think sometimes, you know, just the inside of our head, our minds get so painful, we just want to shut it off in some way.
Yeah. Richard, what do you think, man? We talked a lot about military folks, you know, we're on deployments where, you know, I've gotten, you know, when I was a drill instructor in basic training, I mean, some of those guys would get dear John letters, you know, hey, you know, this isn't working out and, you know, whatever. You know, talk about some of the things that we've seen in our resilience program that kind of raised flags and kind of alarmed us a little bit.
Okay, well, Sean, actually, you know, with the resilience program, one of the central goals was to get people to think about who they are as an individual and the coping skills that they've got presently and how they can either define, refine, or improve their coping mechanisms. And we've seen a lot of individuals say, hey, I've never thought of mindfulness before. I've never thought of self-talk before. And that's kind of opening some new doors for individuals to kind of look at a new approach on how to deal with controversy and challenge and ultimately hardships. One thing I do believe we do right in the Air Force is we have the wingman concept. And, you know, the wingman concept is just like having a good friend you can depend on. But it's deeper than that. It's about building and sustaining relationships, having an honest discourse, believing in the individual next to you, and really essentially helping one another out, but ultimately knowing each other on a deeper level, knowing when to ask the hard questions, basically knowing when to just reach out and say, hey, look, you know, you're not sounding like yourself all of a sudden. What's going on? Let's talk about it. And basically, if you've built that relationship of trust, that's where you can get the honest, okay, look, let me level with you. Here's where I'm at. And from there, of course, just being able to instill hope and faith and the promise that, hey, we're gonna get you through this. We're going to work it together. And looking at all the options available, that type thing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Anyone else have any thoughts about, you know, some of the signs and symptoms, you know, that we start to kind of think about and like, okay, they're exhibiting this, you know, maybe it's time to intervene.
Well, this is John again. I think Richard brings up a good point that I really like that concept of the wingman, because what I've noticed as I've aged is that we men are not very good at maintaining long-term relationships. At least many of us. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went through a divorce 4 years ago and kind of came to my senses, and the people that I thought were my friends weren't around. And so I had to rebuild all new friendships. And so I think one of the key factors is isolation, disconnection. And I think the more that we can institute programs and encourage men in particular, but people in general, to stay connected in some way. And I think that, you know, we as a society in the United States are not very good about encouraging social connection. And I think there are some people that are better at it than others, but I look at, you know, France or Spain, and it seems to me like much of the society is set up for people to interact with other people they don't know. And you come here and even the way the chairs and tables are set up in restaurants and lounges, you're just not encouraged to interact with other people. And so we tend to get more and more isolated the older we get.
And this is Megan. I wanted to add this, you know, because I was active duty and working in the mental health and substance abuse clinic in the Air Force. And, you know, the wingman concept has grown over time. And it is a very, very good program because it keeps accountability for each and every person in your, you know, who you work with. And so outside of the Air Force, well, back to the Air Force just real quick, the hard part is that we may look like everything is good, but, you know, we don't know what happens when people go home at night, because with the Air Force and military, you know, you risk losing your career, you know, if you do indicate those thoughts. And so what I love about the Wingman program is just the, you know, bonding together and, you know, making sure that, you know, there's communication going outside of just, you know, the normal work day. And I think that that's, you know, really important. And I agree as well, like with men, it's not shown to like have very close relationships. And I truly believe that isolation is the key, you know, is the number one, you know, indicating factor. So if you have a friend that usually is really talkative, like texting or on the phone, and, you know, you see them often, and then all of a sudden they just kind of drop off, you know, the isolation is one of the big indicators.
You know, along with isolation, I've heard people that, are they selling their stuff? Are they get like, do they have a favorite pet, a dog, a bird, whatever? Do they have a car that is like their baby? And all of a sudden they're like, nah, I don't care no more. Like, I'm all right, you know? And they're selling different things, and they're decluttering, or they're making peace with things or whatever, you know? Have you seen that, you know, as a sign or symptom that something is not right?
This is Megan again. I'm just going to quick. So when you do like substance abuse assessments, as I'm sure the rest of the experts can say, one of the questions are, you know, have you sold your possessions? Have you, you know, made amends with people and said goodbye to people? You know, so definitely those two things, and selling your possessions and getting finances in order, things like that is definitely an indication.
Awesome.
And
Dr.
Sean,
I got a question. Go ahead, Richard. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to tag on one point here, Sean. This is Richard, of course. You know, we need to change the narrative regarding, you know, human interaction, suicide prevention, to where it's a strength-based approach. For men, you know, we can talk about, you know, the gender and differences and so forth, but for a lot of men, we're taught from early on, hey, it's not okay to hurt. It's not okay to feel or to basically express pain, uncertainty, not be in control. But ultimately, that is a societal situation where no. We need to change the narrative. It's okay to feel. It's okay to express. It's okay to show weakness. And you know, this goes for both men, women, and obviously children and teens. But we need to kind of turn the corner on being legitimate, being honest, taking some risk. And we have a need, you know, basically expressing the need and reaching out. So it should be looked at a strength-based approach regarding the ability and the confidence in those around you, to where you feel, hey, it's okay for me to raise the flag. I know someone's going to be there, and I can feel and express where I'm at.
That's great.
Yeah, and Richard, this is John. If I can jump in there, I absolutely agree with you. And I think there's a precursor to that as well, where men in particular, I think, need to be taught some emotional awareness. I mean, I think the stats are that most men on average can name about 7 emotions. Women are about 17. And, you know, a lot of the men that I see in my practice have a hard time identifying what they're feeling. I mean, they can do basic emotions, but beyond that, it's pretty difficult. I've had, you know, 17-year-olds come in here and argue with me that they're not stressed when their best friend is sitting right next to them saying, dude, you're really stressed. And so I think that there's that piece of it as well, that we need to not only be okay with feeling, understand that we become a better father or husband or employee when we are aware of what we're feeling, but also the step prior to that is figuring out what the heck we are feeling.
Absolutely. Yeah. Totally agree, Dr. Sean. Totally agree.
Mm-hmm. So I got a question for Dr. Aaron. As I read through, you know, all of your accomplishments and everything, how, and I don't know, that's why I'm asking, how does the cognitive behavioral psychology, how does that, what you do, what's the experience, I guess, that you've had inside of the suicide realm, and how is what you do as the cognitive behavioral psychology expert, how does that coincide with suicides and that area?
Oh, thank you.
That's
for
a horrible
the
way to answer that question.
So, I think Dr. John might have mentioned this, but it's when you come from a cognitive behavioral standpoint, it's kind of this understanding or assumption that your brain gives you thoughts that are often uninvited, unwelcome, and they're very automatic and can be very automatic. And cognitive behavioral therapy, where I have seen the most success with it, is if you can get someone to observe their thoughts, it can potentially decrease the believability of the suicidal thought. So I always say your power is not in the first thought. The first thought are unwelcome, uninvited, automatic, learned. Your power is in the second thought. And here's where it really gets helpful. When you've had a suicidal thought, your chances of having it again go up because your brain comes up with that solution again. And so if we can talk about, you know, you're going to be like coming up with this thought maybe for a while. So let's look at, why does it make perfect sense your brain's coming up with this thought as a viable solution? Oh, because I'm in a lot of pain. Okay, let's talk about that. Of course you're in pain. Let's validate your pain. Let's help you cope with your pain. Because what we know from cognitive behavioral therapy is the more that you resist, the more it persists. And the more that you don't want the suffering, the more it hangs around. And so your real power is having a relationship with your thought life. So I remember when I was coming out of my suicidal, you know, time in my life, I would notice that my suicidal thoughts would get triggered when I would get highly stressed, and it was always around the children. And I would notice this kind of connection, like, oh, that must mean I'm really overwhelmed with the children because my brain just told me I should kill myself, and that's not true. Like, it became this thing that I was observing as, why does it make perfect sense this thought's popping up right now? So before you can really get to that level of observing the thought, the more we can help people realize you are not your thoughts, they are not always, like I said, given your permission, and they're not always in your control, the more we can help people kind of maybe entertain the fact that it's not 100% true. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You said something that really kind of just made me realize, like, holy crap. So inside of our resilience training in the military, we talk about mindfulness. We talk about, you know, our thoughts and things. But one of the things that you said is that if you resist, they persist. And one of the theories or one of the research studies that we use is called the white bear phenomena, which was a research study done in 2003, where what it is you try avoiding your thoughts, whether positive or negative, and they can become counterproductive. You know, so I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about it. And you're putting energy towards those thoughts, which makes you think about it even more. Does that sound about It's not about what you're saying.
That's
resist,
exactly
persist, and that.
That's exactly the research. Yes, and it's called cognitive fusion, where you get fused
cognitive
with these
fusion.
Thoughts. And if you can just notice, like, oh, you just arrived. You're joining me for dinner. You're going to ruin my dinner. Like, where did you come? And you kind of have this relationship with your thoughts, or anxiety, or fear. You can then have a chance at manipulating it in a non-judgmental way. Like, all right, well, come on, we're going anyways. Or I know you won't hang out forever. Yeah. Or I'm going to redirect to the present moment, and I may need to do that 1,000 times during the day. I may need to do that. But it's
yeah.
a very hard skill of non-judgmentally observing those thoughts, which is really hard, but it's really mm-hmm. powerful.
Yeah. Dr. John, I got a question for you. Is there a level of acceptance that has to happen? You know, I know that we can't remove, you know, doubt and pain and suffering and some things in life with death and some other things. But is there a level of acceptance that has to happen that says, you know what, this bad thing did happen to me, but I can move on, you know? Talk about that for a second.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, this was alluded to earlier, and I think mindfulness mm-hmm. is a good way to go about that, where you kind of, in a non-judgmental way, allow what's arising to arise without criticizing it or yourself for it happening. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I've been joking around with my girlfriend a lot about lately is we'll tell each other it's all about the story, which means that you could have something bad happen to you, or you could have something good happen to you. Either way, if there's emotion involved, it's going to make a good story. And so, you know, we kind of look at it, that attitude helps us to roll with some, you know, kind of dicey situations. And I think, you know, this was also brought up in the beginning of the show, that I definitely agree that we're in a spot as a society where we can't tolerate distressful emotions, and we think they should go away immediately. And that's not the case. That sometimes you have to sit with uncomfortable emotions, and that's okay. You know, you can tell yourself, okay, I'm getting anxious now, and it's going to pass in a few minutes. I'm just going to sit here and breathe. And I think, you know, as it was being alluded to earlier, I think just having that relationship with your thoughts and with your emotions, knowing what's going on, knowing that what's arising is relatively normal, that helps out tremendously.
Hmm. Yeah. Anyone else have thoughts on that?
This is Megan Fenio. I completely agree with the mindset piece. I really focus on that with patients, is because if you think about it, how many, you know, everything that happens in our life, you know, decisions, everything is really on our mindset, and learning to be comfortable with those negative thoughts, but really being able to, you know, what we say, cognitive restructure, right? Cognitive restructuring your brain. So when you identify those negative thoughts, you can, you know, immediately combat it with something that's positive, right? So it allows you mm-hmm. to say, I acknowledge this negative thought, but it's not going to send me into a spiral. I'm acknowledging it, but here, this is what I'm going to do to change that. So mindfulness and positive self-talk, you know, are true, key, important skills to learn.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think affirmations are huge. Affirmations save me. Like every day I have an affirmation that I say that says, you are intentionally and wonderfully made. You have the ability to inspire and motivate at every turn and every opportunity. So go out today and inspire, motivate, and transcend. You are intentionally and wonderfully made. And every time I say that, my heart just beats faster. You know, mm-hmm. and I look in the mirror and I look at what I'm doing, my facial expressions, and I look at, am I believing it? Am I internalized? Like, do I really have that ability? You know, and I look at all the things that I've done, you know, in the past couple of years, and I'm like, dude, everybody has that ability. Everybody has the ability to stop what they're doing, no matter where you are in life, and write a new chapter. Turn the page and just write a new chapter. If you don't like something, change it. And just write a new chapter. Everybody has the power to change their story. So that's huge. Affirmations, Huge.
This is Megan again. I love what you just said because I call an affirmation girl. There's affirmations all over the place, like for me. And I actually developed the top 100 positive affirmations that's on my website. And it's awesome because people want to really get to learn how to do this self-talk, but they don't know where to start. Right. And so, you know, it's super important, even if you can only find one affirmation, like on one affirmation that you completely 100% believe about yourself, that is the one that you repeat to yourself every single day, a couple times a day. You know, when you identify that negative thought that comes into your mind, you say that affirmation. And then, you know, it becomes habit when you end up saying that, and then you're building some confidence, which in turn you'll be able to add more affirmations to your vocabulary. So yes, I 100% agree with you. Affirmations are huge.
Yeah.
And this is Richard Lambert. I just want to throw one point into the equation here. And I totally agree with what you just shared. Sometimes we just have to stop in the moment, realize kind of that, what is this going to matter in 5 years? Or is it going to matter in 5 years? And the second thought that should also drive the thought process is, what do I have in the way of control of this moment right now? You know, you can take a negative route or you can take a positive route. And that self-talk in the moment, once it's practiced, once it becomes a part of you, is going to be basically at some point, it's going to come free and natural. So we're almost like out on a football field, and you've got a coach, and sometimes we've got to be our own coach to get us through what's before us in that type situation. So affirmations are so huge, so important.
Yeah. Yeah, anyone else want to talk about that?
Yeah, I got one more piece that's tangentially related, and that's the relatively new work on self-compassion, primarily by Kristen Neff. And self-compassion is just that idea of speaking to yourself kindly when things are going wrong or when you make a mistake. And, you know, we've all got that inner critic in us that's really good at yelling at us in our own heads. You know, let's say you're on a diet and you eat that piece of cake at 11 at night, and that inner critic will just tear into you. You know, you loser. Why did you eat that piece of cake? Now you're going to get fat. The flip side of that is, as you practice self-compassion, you can speak to yourself with kind of that coaching voice that Richard mentioned, or like you can speak to yourself as if you were 5 years old and just be like, all right, so you made a mistake, fell off the wagon on the diet. Let's start again tomorrow. No big deal. We got this. We can do it again. We'll try again tomorrow. And I think that's a really critical component. And the research has shown that self-compassion seems to be a more powerful tool than something like self-esteem, which has shown itself to be a mixed bag. And that was kind of alluded to in the beginning of the show as well, that with self-esteem, we're looking at, let's tell everyone they're fantastic, regardless of what they're doing, just so we can boost their how they feel about themselves. And we did succeed in raising a generation of children's self-esteem. But the problem with it was that we raised kids' self-esteem so they felt better about themselves, even when some were using and abusing other kids. So not a real good global tool. You know, self-compassion, well, to go back to self-esteem, the other problem with self-esteem is it ties your emotional state to whatever your last achievement was. So, for instance, in school, if you do well on your latest test, your self-esteem is high. If you get an F, you feel terrible about yourself. With self-compassion, it gives you a more even emotional kind of graph or mood or, balance. So you learn to deal with the highs and the lows a little bit better, because those lows are going to come. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to disappoint people. And the more kindly you can learn to speak to yourself after that, the more quickly you rebound emotionally, which speaks to resilience.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. So Dr. Aaron, I got a question for you. During all of your practice and the people that you talk to and everything, and it's kind of a question for everybody, but I'm curious, Dr. Aaron, do you ever assess someone if they're like left-brained, right-brained, kind of inside of psychology? Do you have a lot of experience with that, What is left brain?
No,
what is right brain? As I
no, I don't have any.
That's funny. I'm learning.
I'm
like,
embracing
in preparation
my vulnerability
in preparation
right now.
For the show. Yeah. Well, I was getting preparation. I'm like, okay, if I'm gonna have experts on here, I've got to do some research. And the more I dug in, I was like, what is that? And I started to find myself going down rabbit holes. But one of the things that I found was that someone is left brain or someone is right brain, and there's like a ladderization part, you know. And so I'm kind of curious if anybody has done any work, like how do you know if someone is left brain or even does that even matter with suicides, right? Because one side is one way and one side's the other way. You know, left brain is, you know, analytical, logical. Right brain is said to have been thoughtful, you know, more thoughtful, creative. So can you speak to, like, does it even matter what kind of, you know, right side, left brain are you if you're suicidal,
sure,
or if you're going through something hard?
The kind of, this is Dr. Aaron. The conceptualization that has been useful to me comes out of dialectical behavior therapy, which is that we kind of have these two brains, a rational brain and an emotional brain. So this kind of speaks to it a little bit. And some people highly live in their rational brain and some people highly live in their emotional brain. And the idea is when you find this perfect union of two, that's called a mindful state of being, right? When you find someone that is suicidal or having suicidal ideation, they're obviously very much in the emotional brain. And when we are in emotional brain, it's very hard to be rational. Think of like a 3-year-old temper tantruming. That's not when we sit them down and try to reason with them, right? And so the more we can help people get into a more rational state and cope with their emotion brain, the more useful it is to kind of deregulate and decrease that emotional distress. But I definitely anecdotally, when I see my patients that are highly rational, they will say, yeah, of course I've thought about suicide, but that's just, you know, ridiculous for all these following reasons. And
sure,
when those people get super emotional, they're much more at risk for suicidality. But people that live in their emotion brain highly, they're very much at risk because they believe those emotions as an indicator of now I must do something about them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow.
So neither one is right or wrong. It's just how you cope depends on how highly rational you are or highly emotional you are in that moment.
I think it's very useful knowing how somebody is, you know, if they're in that emotional state, okay, I can't reason with them, you know, at this moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyone else have thoughts? No? Okay. No worries.
I'll jump in real quickly. This is Richard Lambert. You know, with the individual that focuses or operates more out of the emotional state, primarily during their given course of the day, I think that the real serious danger area for them is when they combine that emotional state or emotional orientation and they've got a situation they're being confronted with, they turn to alcohol and or drugs, and then it's almost a synergenic effect, you know, synergy in the sense that, okay, you've got the emotions, you add the alcohol, you add the chemical, the drug, what have you, and it's a double whammy for a lot of individuals. So I can see there being a distinct difference in the orientation. You got the guy that's logical and I'm going to work through this, and you've got the guy or the gal or whomever that's emotional. All too often, some people do turn to that crutch of a chemical, and I think therein lies a big challenge, you know, for individuals to work through given circumstances.
Yeah, we see that a lot. So, for anybody listening out there to the live show, if anything has resonated with you, we'd love for you to, you know, look us all up on Facebook and and subscribe to the show and leave comments and we love hearing about your stories. I mean, just on, you know, a couple of the Facebook profiles, you know, that we had posted on, I mean, it was like, oh my gosh, I lost this person. I read that somebody lost somebody December 3rd. You know, I'm like, oh my gosh, like it's so tough. So we have time for one or two, if anybody's listening, one or two phone calls. So if you need to call in ask one of our experts a question. The number is 657-383-1109. Again, the number is 657-383-1109. So I'll start with Dr. John. I got a question for everybody. We'll start with Dr. John. What can I do? What can you do? What can we all do to make a dent, right? To really reach out and to stop people from committing suicide. What is it that we need to do?
I think it's a really good question. I think that one of the things we can do is be more outgoing, reach out to people that we see in need. Part of that includes being less judgmental. I think part of it, just along a CBT model, the cognitive behavioral therapy model, is getting better individually and teaching others how to get better at identifying those negative thoughts, challenging them, looking for the evidence to support or disprove them, and then figuring out what kind of distortion is this thought, and then reframing it. So let me give you an example of that. So let's say I go to a party and I feel really nervous and I think, oh my God, I'm socially awkward. Nobody wants to hang out with me. So if I can be rational and look at that objectively, I can say, well, yeah, I mean, I can function well at work and I can function pretty well at home. So I must not be socially awkward. I have some friends that enjoy my company. So then you look at what kind of distortion is this? And in this case, it's an overgeneralization. So you want to kind of use that assessment to delegitimize the thought. So you can go something like, well, my discomfort at the party was specific to that group of people where I didn't know anyone. And it doesn't really say anything about me as a person. And then the last step is you act on that. Act on that newly reformulated thought in ways that flow logically from it. So, you can act with a little bit more confidence in other settings. You can operate in ways that maybe reduce the anxiety that you feel going to a party so you can arrive early, ask friends for introductions, and so on. You know, the key is that I think we don't want to believe all our thoughts as true. And that's a really big idea. A lot of the clients that I see aren't even aware of most of their thoughts. And then the thoughts that they are aware of, I think at a younger age at least, they just assume that they're true because they're in their head. And so that skill of learning to identify, challenge, and reframe becomes critical.
Yeah. Dr. Aaron, what do you think? What can we do?
Oh my gosh, probably so many things, but the thought I'm having that I would love to share is, you know, shame hates when we speak about things. Depression hates it when we talk about it. So the more we talk about it, the better we're all going to be. And so, you know, look at Sean and I, we shared that we are survivors and it's opening up a discussion. So that's what I would love to add to that piece.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for sharing yours too. Megan.
Yes. I'm a huge advocate of, you know, self-talk and positive self-talk. And so just really kind of going on what's already been said is, you know, identifying those negative thoughts and how to combat them. And I really like, you know, what was said about the shame and the guilt and the depression, and just allowing yourself to be in that moment, which we've talked about, you know, multiple times in this episode, is allowing yourself to be in this moment and, you know, to feel that, but making sure that you have a lot of tools in your tool belt, like I like to say, in regards to coping with those. And, you know, making sure that your support system is, you know, is vitally important as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Richard.
Okay, Sean, basically, I think one important point is that it's all about giving relationships. It's about, you know, essentially being intentional. It's about building strength in a relationship and ultimately about building trust. And what I mean by that is that, you know, I had a good friend of mine. He unfortunately passed away on a motorcycle accident, but he was the type of individual that when he asked you, hey, how are you doing? He legitimately and intentionally wanted to know, how are you doing? And I think it's those seemingly almost insignificant encounters that we have every day that we engage in, they ultimately are going to build relationships. If you know the person that's in front of you that's asking, hey, I'm serious, how you doing today? I really want to know. It's small things like that that we can basically do every day of our existence to not only feel good about ourselves, but to help others feel good about who they are and just reinforce the fact we're all in this together.
Yeah. I just want everybody to know that you are not alone. Whatever you're feeling, I guarantee you someone else has felt the exact same way. But I promise you, you are not the only one who has ever had the thought, the feeling, whatever you're going through. You're not the only one who has ever experienced whatever you have experienced. So that's pretty critical. In the Air Force, we have something called ASK, care and escort, ACE. You know, you got to ask them. You know, like how are you feeling? I generally want to know, like Richard said, I legitimately want to know. I always ask, how are you feeling? What are you doing? And, then it's caring about that person. I'm beginning to research a lot about emotional intelligence, and I absolutely love emotional intelligence. And I think that goes, into empathy, not sympathy, right? I mean, if we're creating, like Dr. John said, these atmospheres, that we're creating, how are we navigating through those? Everything changing so fast. How are we navigating, through those? So I think that, with, the risks that we have, with domestic violence and alcohol and drugs and the way we've grown up. And I mean, I've known people that came from loving households, but they just, for some reason, didn't feel valued themselves. They didn't feel loved. They didn't, that speaks to a lot of, different people, that are going through that. But I think that what we're doing today, bringing awareness to it, it's drawn out people that said that I've lost somebody and I've dealt with this and I'm a survivor and I've, and it seems to be a topic that is in real big discussion today. For those of you who don't know and who are listening, the third Monday is considered Blue Monday because this is the time, this is the week that everybody is starting to maybe fail in their goals or they don't think that 2018 was coming out to be the way that they planned. And so we just want to, all of us, from the bottom of our heart, want to address this topic because it is such it's one of those topics that just pulls on your heartstrings too much. You know what I mean? Someone dying prematurely always, is bad, but just somebody taking their own life, especially teenagers, because of social media and, people who can't get out of, depression or substance abuse. So if you're suffering, please, please, please call the suicide hotline. There are people waiting. There are people who care about you. There are people who want to help you out. And if you need to call that hotline, the number to the suicide hotline or in depression, anxiety, PTSD, they all have a hotline that you can call. But if you have somebody who is suicidal or is thinking about suicide, please call. There's a depression hotline at 888-737-5178. Again, the number is 888-737-5178. And I'm sure that the experts here have different places that they can call. But the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, open 24 hours a day, is 1-800-273-8255. So for the guests, is there any topic that maybe we didn't cover or something that you really want to address here today? Or maybe we covered it all.
This is Megan Fenio. I just want to stress, and I know we talked about it, and you said it too, is just, stress to people that they're not alone. In my work in substance abuse, the one thing with patients they always tell me is, because we do a lot of group treatment and there's a lot of hesitation with group treatment. And the one thing is they say is, I was so hesitant, but it's so good to know that I'm not alone, that people understand. And so, just reiterating that fact that you are not alone and that there's help out there. And, I just want to encourage, people to reach out for that help.
Perfect.
And Sean, if I can dovetail on that, one of the things that I talk to my clients that are depressed about is this idea that when you're depressed, you've got a different set of glasses on that you're seeing the world through. And so you don't quite see things accurately. You believe those negative thoughts. You believe those negative emotions. And when I've dealt with my own depression, what I realized was that I was often one of the last to realize that my mood had changed. And what I realized was that I needed to trust loved ones around me and get their feedback. And when they said something like, gee, John, you're getting a little bit irritable, or you seem a little down, that was a big red flag for me to look at, okay, where's my mood at? And so those of you that suffer from depression or have suicidal thoughts, like, please listen to the loved ones around you. Give them a heads up when you're doing well and just say, hey, listen, if you see my mood go down, just give me a heads up.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else before we close out the show?
Yeah, you know, Sean, if I could just add one thing, Richard here, is it all goes back to relationships and building relationships of trust. And, you know, I've said this before, and particularly one-on-one directly, you know, with you. You know, if I could really be king for a day and make a decree or make a change in society, it would simply be that we as a society, we educate our children, aside from reading, writing, and math and so forth, that every semester, every school year of a child's life, it would be required that the children have at least one life skill class per term, per semester, per year, from 1st through 12th, even in the college. I believe right now with the hectic pace of our world and our over-dependence in technology and, you know, the electronics and so forth, we kind of need to get back to basics. So if it were up to me, we would work and focus from day one with our children to improve self-esteem, provide ironclad coping skills, and essentially, again, provide a life skills curriculum from day one in school to the very end that would promote the four pillars of resilience, which are mental, physical, social, and spiritual. That's just my, if I were king for a day. So if I'm ever king for a day, that's my number one decree that I'll make.
That's awesome. All right, so as we close the show, Dr. John, if someone wants to get a hold of you, find you, talk to you, how can we make that happen?
They can email me at john@guidetoself.com, and that's GUIDETOSELF.com.
Awesome. Dr. Aaron, how can people find you and get a hold of you and talk to you?
Oh, thank you. You can go to my website at www.thepsychologyofmission.com. Thepsychologyofmission.com. Thank you.
And Megan.
You can also go to my website. It's www.missionstrengthsd.com. So Mission Strength, S as in Sam, D as in dog.com.
Perfect. And Richard, we have a Facebook group dedicated to the resiliency topic called Resiliency Think Tank. And there's a lot of military resilience instructors, and there's some resilience folks in the positive psychology realm. And I invite our experts to check it out. It's a Facebook group. We kind of just drop things in there. And Richard and I, especially him, I mean, he's masterminded this whole resilience community in the Air Force. And I really have learned so much from him. So, Richard, I want to thank you, you know, for being on the show. And this has been great. All of you, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Thanks to all. Take care.
So as we close the show, I always say, live your brand. Find opportunities every day to live out the values that you hold deep in your heart. And I call that living your brand. You have the power to write a new chapter, to not put an address in a mailbox on this depression, anxiety, or these suicidal thoughts. Pack up, go to the other side, go through it, grow through it, grow through everything you're going through, because what you're going through is preparing you for where you're going to. And so as we close, I just want you to realize that you are not alone. And as the experts have said today, everyone has had thoughts, even the experts has had thoughts. So you are not alone. And so until next episode, live your brand and have a good night.